gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room, number 275. It is another quarter quill. Guys, do you remember when we did our first Fighting in the War Room quarter quill? This would be episode number 25.
It was so long ago that people knew what a quarter quill was.
Oh, yeah, no. When we first did them for Operation Kino, the Hunger Games movies had not come out yet. And it was like a deep cut, like, oh, if you've read the books, you know.
Yeah, but then we outlasted the Hunger Games franchise.
I think none of us have read the books, it's safe to say.
Oh, I've read the books.
I read half of the first book.
I read them all like one Christmas break one time. It was fun. I'm sorry, holiday break. When we recorded our first quarter quill was June 3rd, 2014.
Wow.
That's a late, because we started the podcast right around the release of Rabbit Hole, right?
We did, but that was the Operation Kino. We did the
sure, but those years count.
Yeah,
those were
They're just harder. It's harder to find those quarter quills. But you can at fightinginthewarroom.com.
What was our first Fighting in the War Room one about?
It was our filmmaking quarter quill, where we all talked about films we'd made.
Oh my god,
man!
Dark
super
web.
Fun.
Do you have to go to find the quarter Operation Kino quarter quills?
Yeah. Dave, what's this one about?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm getting there.
Oh,
building
sorry.
That.
Okay.
Then we did Movies for the Moment, which was about how things were back in, late 2014. Wow. So that was, I don't know, leading up to like a Star Wars and stuff. Anyway, not important. Then we did Movies We Wanted to Be When We Grow Up. Then we did The Significant Other quill, where had other people come in, the people we were dating or married to at the time. Then we had Movies We Wanted to Show Our Children. Or just wanted to show children, ours in parentheses, depending on if we had children or not. Movies that represent what we want for America. I'm guessing that's around 2016. revisiting previous infamous discussions was Fighting in the War Room 175. Fighting in the War Room 200 was the foreign Netflix quill, where we watched foreign films on Netflix. Fighting the War Room number 225 was the lifelong evolving obsession quill. And our most recent one, number 250, was the New York movie quill. If you have seen like a theme here, we choose themes, we each choose a movie that we talk about that adheres to that episode's theme. But it also has like a personal twist, mostly because we chose them sometimes more forcibly. This episode will be about the best movie of the past 10 years.
Is it best? Is it the best movie, or is it?
It is best asterisk, as in whatever you want best to mean in the situation. I'm not sure I think I that, picked the best
one. That was not the criteria. I thought it was.
It's like the movie
of the
decade. No, it's
the movie that like most represents the decade.
I think that's right. Yeah, I think.
Yeah.
Okay, and not necessarily on like a personal level, but like what the decade was.
Well, it's still
world.
A personal. It's your personal takeaway from the decade applied to a film that represents.
I think all those things are correct. I
best
categorize
movie of the
them
decade,
as basically. Best of the movie of the decade.
Yeah.
I don't. I mean, I think all the movies we picked are all.
You're gonna have like 15 minutes to right. self-define your movie later in this episode. All right, here we go. Each going to go in order of these movies released, which means I get to go first, as my movie was released in 2010, in fall of 2010. It is David Fincher's The Social Network. And if the score just jumped into your head, yeah, there we go. I was playing that the other day, just randomly in the morning, because I think it's like kind of calming but also melancholy. The track is called "Hand Covered Bruise" by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, part of the Social Network score, and it plays over the opening credits as he's wandering back from being dumped by Rooney Mara that will scar him so much he'll create a billion-dollar company. In this movie, why do I like The Social Network, or why did I pick it as the movie of the past 10 years that I think represents the best past 10 years, or maybe is the best of the past 10 years? I think this idea of like the tech disruptor and like the misplaced ambition of our I guess brain trust of youth that have now become the like Silicon Valley movers and shakers of the new business. But at the time where our generation, sort of being thrust into a workforce that was very different, from what we figured out and like other, or very different from what our parents had figured out, I'd been told about. And I think, like every group of workers has their own like get rich scheme movie, I feel like The Social Network is for ours. As a movie, I feel like it's propulsive. The Aaron Sorkin script, you know, cuts back and forth through different depositions, which should be absolutely boring, but it manages to pace the movie in a way that I don't ever get bored, even while we're watching The Social Network, just because the way that it's shot and the story is sort of doled out, dovetails with the performances by Andrew Garfield and, Mark Zuckerberg.
Jesse Eisenberg.
Yes, I was about to say the Zombieland guy, but at least I said Mark Zuckerberg.
Wow, what a current cultural reference.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's current and was sort of current there, but I do think that, you know, the Mark Zuckerberg guy will be a way to describe Jesse Eisenberg for the rest of his life, because he's amazing in this and for a long period of time before Zuckerberg himself was, you know, like repeatedly drawn in front of Congress. That was the face that would be conjured in my mind to represent like all of this. Like,
there's
social
definitely
network.
Still a feeling of when I see a photo of Mark Zuckerberg, because he has, you know, been meeting with conservative leaders or whatever reason he's in the news, or there's a half second where I look at him and I'm like, wait, who is that? And it takes a second for me, like, wait, that is what he looks like? I mean, he looks like such like a nothing of a human being.
Yeah, Jesse Eisenberg did him a lot of favors.
It's like beige. Yeah, no, absolutely.
I think that was the cool thing, because I remember this movie being developed and like Aaron Sorkin getting on Facebook and being like, what should I know about a Facebook movie? And me being this is going to be absolute trash. I can't believe this is a movie. And then that first trailer came out with the children singing along the sad piano and the How Do You Make a Billion Friends.
It was a cover of Creep, wasn't it?
It was a cover of Creep, yes.
And that was before the like sad piano cover of a pop song was like such an overused thing in trailers. It felt fresher then, I swear.
That is why the covers of music became overused in trailers.
Well, I don't know if that's true. It started with Mad World and that Gears of War trailer. Anyway.
That's probably all.
I wouldn't say it's an excellent movie on its own, placed as something that has to speak for the decade. I do like what it says. It's sort of what I outlined. I guess what I'm a little worried about is it doesn't speak to a lot of things that might be, I think, universal, that will also be associated with this decade. It doesn't have, you know, I could have picked like Moonlight and talked about the cultural impact of that maybe, but I feel like The Social Network, I felt it because I felt like we all lived through that apex of social networking, that I guess now in history will be like the time it was a good thing, maybe. I don't know. There's a weird time in my life that I knew you guys definitely, and we were doing a podcast that like my certain groups of friends would like check in on Foursquare, or you'd know where people were at because of like Facebook posts or like tweets. And there was a whole period of time where that was the actual sociability, to then have it shown how that was created out of sort of like this angry man in his Harvard dorm room, I think really dramatizes the spirit of the nation, how we took something that was, you know, made out of a bad place and for a second made it really cool, but then couldn't help but like make it absolute shit again, which is the sine wave of the internet, I guess, at this point, which is, yeah.
Angry men, angry white men in particular, is going to be a recurring theme throughout the film.
Yeah, we picked a bunch of white male movies.
Yeah, well, Java was yelling at me about that earlier.
We picked a bunch of white male movies that are not sympathetic to the white male.
Definitely, I wouldn't say it's necessarily the story of the decade, but a story of a decade was definitely white men reckoning with, well, the rest of the world reckoning with white men.
But do you feel like the conversation around The Social Network when it came out in 2010 was about
that?
Yeah, why not? I guess.
I mean, we weren't
having those conversations the way that we are now.
Yeah, we weren't. But I think that, I think the conversation was a lot more geared towards a generation looking at itself with what Dave was saying about the very concept of a Facebook movie. There was so much hand-wringing about the truth when I think to even go down that road sort of completely misses the point of the movie.
It was a lot of worry about it being fair to Mark Zuckerberg, which is not something you can imagine anyone worrying about now.
But I also think the concentration was more on Eduardo, played by Andrew Garfield. I feel like that was the real – it was about two friends splitting up and being blown apart by kind of a capitalistic goal, or one person being a genius and the other person falling behind in the spotlight. And it was really about their relationship. And now we look back at the movie and see – Zuckerberg, or at least Eisenberg's version of Zuckerberg, as this kind of monster who's emerged. I feel like it's a one-sided, it's all about someone lashing out at other people from the very first scene, in this case his girlfriend, and then the creation of the Hot or Not platform that becomes Facebook. It's all about lashing out. It's all about thinking you're high and mighty and powerful and using the quest for goodness against people. But at the time, I really thought it was more about Eduardo's character, and in rewatching it time and time again throughout this last decade, that has really kind of fallen away from me. It's more about this kind of bizarre Zuckerberg character.
I didn't think it was about him thinking he's powerful. It's that he thinks he's not powerful, and the whole thing where he's like the nerd who wants to get into the club, and he doesn't think that like people are paying attention to what he does. So he uses like the one tool at his disposal, which is code. And he has to have people tell him over and over again, like, you are the giant in this situation. You know, Sean Parker comes in and tells him how to run his business. And he's like not really thinking in those terms at all, which again is a really different version of Mark Zuckerberg than what we have now. But I found him more sympathetic, I think, than you did looking back at it, Patches.
In this most recent rewatch, you thought he was a sympathetic character.
Not like a fully sympathetic character, but I definitely thought of him as a human with like understandable human desires that, you know, were executed poorly most times.
I think like seeing how the actual person evolved even more so now, you see him be like absolutely frustrated throughout like the entire movie. Like there's not a moment except maybe the dinner with Sean Parker, or in the club again with Sean Parker, that Katie was talking about, where like his ego's actually in a good place. Otherwise, he's always worrying about trying to like impress somebody, or how he's estimated, or what sort of recognition he's demanding from what type of person. From the board, memorably, but also doesn't want to hear that his ways are wrong because he knows he's the smartest person in the room. So I think it still works.
Well, it's also that feeling of, oh, sorry, go on. I thought you were done.
Oh, no, I think it still works that at the end, like even with Rashida Jones being nice to him because she's like a lawyer, he like kind of misreads that, because the entire, time he's trying to make a connection to somebody and he can't. He just makes the Facebook and money.
Yeah.
I think it's very much a movie about, you know, that extrapolates at least from the feeling of young and capable and having the energy and ire to sort of change the world in your image, and the frustrations that, I mean, this is divorced from all of the sort of foundational feelings that provoke Mark Zuckerberg in the movie, but that feeling of wanting to make this your world, wanting to put your stamp on it, and the frustrations that come with the reality of doing so, and the pain of the interpersonal dilemmas that come along the way, and how those two things, you know, making people like you and exerting some sort of agency control over your universe are not always compatible and often, you know, directly incompatible. And I think that, you know, so much of the movie is reduced to that, even though, you know, there's so much else going on. But I like how the movie is, while you could watch that last shot and think, you know, really it was all as simple as him being spurned by this girl and trying to make him elevate himself to a place where, you know, she would look up to him, look up at him, you know, where he was, that really was as tall as if you were sitting on someone else's shoulders, or whatever that line is that I'm twisting, or, that Eduardo tells him.
Or if you were Army Hammer.
Yeah, right. But, you know, I think that what's interesting about the movie and what's so brilliant about Sorkin's screenplay is that that is really just one of many parallel threads that is running through it the entire time. And to reduce this movie to that one thesis is difficult to the point of sort of willful ignorance.
I think that's like one of the points along the, oh yeah, we should definitely talk about Abraham, but along the constellation of like just the dark side of what it means, like what the disruptor mindset means. It means like I'm smart enough that all sorts of like institutions and other people are fucking wrong, and I'm going to push this through with the might of the fucking mob behind me. And that therefore justifies me as being a successful person or a businessman. I think The Social Network does a really good job even now of showing how like that's absolutely not true. And it took us a decade to learn that. And now, mm-hmm. you know, we get to side eye our Elon Musks, and not take them as gods, in the future.
Do you think that there is a specific millennial read on this movie that makes it the movie of the decade for you, Dave? For me, I thought a lot, I spent, especially the latter half of this decade, thinking a lot about how earlier on, millennials were the ambitious generation, and there were 30 under 30 lists and 25 under 25 lists, and this pursuit.
They still make those.
No, I know. They faded away a bit. Yes, now that I'm ineligible, I don't screw.
What's happened
is
that you've gotten older and are less interested in reading those things.
Yes,
they're
absolutely.
Still out there.
No, I know they're still out there, but they're, you know, as millennials grow older, we have distance from that, and I can't speak as a, like a Gen Zer, floating through that. But certainly, I think there was a different path that millennials were on, that we had, the power to make our own lives, and we could do anything, and we were coming off a generation that was comfortable, and yeah, we could go get ourselves the lives that we wanted to live. And I think that blew up in a lot of our faces, or at least some of us had to make hard choices about what we wanted to do in this world. I've talked to a lot of creatives over the last 10 years about, you know, how do you really make it as a great artist, or someone who is making big blockbusters in Hollywood, or someone who is building a giant tech company. You know, you have to sacrifice so much. And a lot of millennials found themselves putting relationships aside, or putting kids aside, or putting whatever aside, making large sacrifices, not talking to their families, just going in a hole and building the next Facebook or something, or making a big movie. So many sacrifices were made, and I think millennials might have thought it was going to be easier, or I don't know. I feel like the millennial narrative has soured a bit, and maybe that happens to every generation, but we're at the point right now where it seems clear that what we thought millennials were supposed to get, it didn't work out that way. And social networks.
What you're getting at is that we had a whole bunch of promise and we didn't fix it, I think, is what you're getting at.
So far.
I also think that, like, Aaron Sorkin writing about millennials is sort of like the writing staff of Euphoria writing about, you know, teenagers with drug addictions and you know, neurological differences.
You love Euphoria.
Always got to talk about Euphoria.
You love Euphoria.
I actually think neuroatypical characters are the one thing that Euphoria didn't really have. So I don't know why I called that out. But I think that it is – this movie does lend itself to being read as a generational portrait, but I think that a lot of that is sort of built from scraps in the periphery and sort of an impression that we get through the particular lens that we're looking through it. I don't know if Aaron Sorkin is operating on that level, for better or worse.
Yeah. I want to like chime in as the token woman for a minute, and because I've been thinking since we mentioned about like the overwhelming whiteness of this movie, and I think if it came out now, I think that would be more of a big deal. Even though I don't think it's like about unexamined privilege, I think in the depiction of the Winklevoss twins, you have some examination of privilege and like Mark Zuckerberg's relative lack of it compared to them, even though they're all at Harvard. So who cares? You've basically got like one major non-white character in Max Minghella's character, but I like the fact that all of the women who show up in this movie basically throughout are like looking at these guys being like, wait, what? Like, what are you all tearing yourself up about? Like, there's this like skepticism kind of built into all the female characters that I guess falsely, if you're a woman in tech, it maybe sets up the idea of tech as being all male, which is untrue. But I like that, like, from Rooney Mara onward, you've got women who show up to look at all of this bullshit that they're throwing around at each other in a way that comes up in The Wolf of Wall Street and maybe some of the other stuff that we're talking about. It's more insightful than I remembered it being.
Oh, yeah. That sounds like a great high point to go out on and move on to.
Oh, my God.
Our
it's already time
bit.
To move on from The Social Network. Jesus.
It is.
What a rich text.
That was it. Social Network. Go back, watch it. There's tons of stuff. We have another episode where we revisited The Social Network.
So revisit like, our definitely. Social Network episode on.
Let's just shout out to Dakota Johnson, who was in her first role, who is great in one scene. That's all.
Hell yeah. All right. Next, it's Patches.
Yeah. So I picked a movie that I got to see at Sundance, and it was a full theater when I went in, and it was a near empty theater when I walked out. And I just checked the Rotten Tomatoes page, and this sits at a 58 rotten percent, which is right. That feels really right for a movie that I think was kind of misread at the time, and I have absolutely no idea if it has a legacy or not now. Most likely no, because people...
Well, I think its legacy has been sublimated into movies like Mr. America.
Okay, which no one is seeing right now.
Which you and I mean something.
Okay. So David and I both really liked this movie when it came out. David gave it a 5 out of 5 review on BoxOfficePro.com. I'm sorry, R.I.P. Box Office Magazine, yes.
Box Office Magazine at the time.
And I flipped for it. It was my number one movie of 2012, and that movie is The Comedy, directed by Rick Alverson, and written by Rick and a bunch of his cohorts, Colm O'Leary, Robert Dunn, and starring Tim Heidecker and a bunch of other goofballs, including Eric Wareheim, is Tim and Eric co-star, James Murphy of LCD Sound System, or he is LCD Sound System, and Greg Turkington.
Who has like three lines in the whole movie, which is funny.
He just sits there with his big beard, stroking his
beard.
He's
there.
He's a good hipster.
Sliding on pews.
Yeah, good. And Greg Turkington is in the movie, and Rick Alverson made entertainment after this with Greg Turkington playing Neil Hamburger, which is a whole other
game. And you have since become Rick Alverson fanboy number one.
I really am. I had the privilege. I highly recommend seeing Rick's new movie that came out this year called The Mountain. I got to do a big DVD commentary for him when that movie comes out from Kino Lorber later this year. That's besides the point, because this is the first movie of Rick's that I saw, and I just got knocked out. And it all came rushing back to me rewatching the movie for this podcast. And the setup is basically Tim Heidecker plays this guy Swanson, who, you know, he's upper crust. I don't know. Do they live in like Connecticut or where do you think his rich dad
Island.
Lives?
I figure if you got a boat that's coming around easily to the Hudson River,
he's loaded and living in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, and just doing nothing with his life except joking and drinking beers and joking and ruining the lives of others. He's a cynical bastard of a human being, a complete piece of shit, and
he's
totally recognizable. Totally recognizable to anyone, I think, who has spent time in Brooklyn. And for me, after rewatching this movie, you know, 8 years later, because I guess I saw it in 2011, wow, it's like, it's just every part of the Twitter experience for me, the social media experience. It's every part of every argument, every pocket, every bubble that we talk about has people like Swanson existing in it. And I was so kind of blown away as this symbol of dumb shit, played by someone who could easily be perceived as the greatest symbol of dumb shit. If you're watching Tim and Eric, if you love this ironic humor, it's been completely weaponized and thrown back in your face. There's really funny parts of Tim's performance in this. At some point, he's like scrubbing his teeth with a toothbrush and all the toothpaste is coming out of his mouth. That's funny. That's funny. He does a Nick Nolte impression when he's talking about, that's some good pot. And that's really funny. I gotta say,
it's all really funny.
Funny. And then the disintegration loops will kick in, or someone will have a seizure for like 2 minutes and he's still joking or still staring into space. He's completely devoid of emotion. And you suddenly realize what all this comedy has done to him, what all this irony has done to us, and what, I don't know, joking through existence has done to society. Everything is disintegrating because we cannot deal with reality. And I guess to draw
this back to the previous movie we were discussing, I mean, it is, we can take to center this conversation around white men, I think just men in general and grappling with masculinity and the inaccessibility or unwillingness to engage with their feelings in a sincere way, which is really at the root of what this movie is doing. But so much of The Social Network hinges on that as well, about like the unwillingness to confront that vulnerability and the fears and jealousies and desires and ego trips and all those things. And this movie wraps all that stuff and pulls it, like piles it so deep under layers of irony and peevishness that it takes a lot to get back up.
And I remember seeing this movie at Sundance, as I mentioned, and just being just knocked out because I saw traces of myself in this character. I saw traces of my friends. I saw traces of people that I grew up knowing because I love making people laugh and I love being silly and I love walking around the street and drinking a beer and being a goofball. And you can see yourself slipping into that level of irony when you are either enjoying company or being in one of these cultural bubbles. And at that time, Katie, you mentioned at the top of The Social Network thing, we just weren't having conversations maybe about like this level of white privilege or how it's seeped and poisoned so much of culture. It's part of everyone. It's everyone's universal sin on some level. And it's just like, yeah, this is real. And before those conversations were happening, I felt like I had been knocked out. I almost mentally prepared for everything that online discourse or cultural discourse as a whole was about to undergo. It was a really eye-opening experience for me through Rick Alverson's provocateurship. You know, I worry today where a lot of provocateurship comes under immediate fire or is quickly misinterpreted and goes through a ringer. I do worry about the state of provocateurship. I'm not like Bill Maher worried about woke hate, you know, I'm not a woke hated comedian.
No one's allowed to be funny anymore.
Yeah, and I think this movie confronts a little bit that too, and I'd be interested to hear what you guys think just about like the state of comedy.
I'm glad that you clarified that you are not Bill Maher because resemblance is uncanny.
New rule. Sorry. But I do worry that like a movie, even like this, may not get away with it, or people who try and push buttons and put a Swanson character in a black bar where he is being a total asshole to these people and being a racist, and or there's a scene where he is convincing a cab driver to let him buy him off and let him drive the cab, and he totally ruins the man's life, and it's just so staggering to watch a white man just interfere and then be able to run away and go to his next prank. It's like a horror movie that ends up being really funny at times and dangerously so. What did you guys all make of the comedy 7 years later?
So I'm going to, I think, hit that part of your last question a little bit, which is like, I could recognize it's a good movie and I saw what it was doing, but that didn't make the process of watching it towards the end any more pleasurable because it is.
It's not a pleasure. It's not a pleasure.
Exactly. Exactly. It is a movie where you're going to watch somebody punch down and not necessarily punch down in a way that is super witty or in like some sort of, I don't know, cultural critique sort of way. It's not it's a comment, it's not a satire, I guess would be a way to put it. Like there's not a point in this movie where you're going to be like, oh, this film's so witty, or that joke was like genuinely funny. I think if you happen across a funny joke in the movie, you're also supposed to feel kind of self-conscious, because the second you laugh, you're recontextualized back with him into wherever he is, you know, yelling about owning slaves and his sister-in-law who he tries to hit on, like, later. Like, every time you think that maybe the movie is going to, like, pivot and become slightly more like its title, it doubles down on making you feel uncomfortable. So, I don't know. It's a good movie I don't like. There have been movies, like you were saying, provocateurship has existed in cinema before. And, you know, I've always made jokes about things like a Serbian film or whatnot. So I'm not unused to this cinema, but this was my first time confronting it, I guess, past the age of like 33, where I was like, I don't know. I don't like what this makes me uncomfortable. Like, reading too much of the news makes me uncomfortable. Like, I know it's true. I just want it to stop because there's nothing I could do about it.
Yeah.
Like, I see it everywhere. The comedy is the shortest movie we're going to talk about on this episode, and it felt like the longest.
Yeah, I feel
like the longest movie of my entire life.
It is a difficult. It's not enjoyable. It's not enjoyable. But I go to the movies to not necessarily enjoy myself. That's a weird thing to say, but it's just true. But yeah, it's so funny that you say reading the news and that sort of thing, Dave, because I had the same feeling watching this movie, where I'm like, we hear about a type of person like this every day from doing something in local news, and
explain this to me further. I'm still not caught up on this idea that there is a Swanson in everyone's life.
Really? Well, yeah, not in everyone's life.
Who fails to have a human conversation over a 90-minute movie. Like, I don't know anyone like that. I know people who use comedy or to use like humor to cope with things that they're not comfortable talking about. But the idea of someone with absolutely no consequences to their life who never has a real conversation and who can watch someone have a seizure without reacting.
Oh, well, I think Swanson is a worst case scenario character. I mean, we could talk about if he's a construct or if people like this really exist. They do. But most of us may not have a Swanson in our lives, but we have people who may exhibit Swanson-like tendencies or have a Swanson-like online personality or be removed from the world in a different kind of way. That's not through the same ironic humor, but staves off the conversations that we have on a daily basis, recontextualizing culture and our existences and checking our privilege, if you will.
Entirely joking earlier. I mean, I wasn't really joking at all when I mentioned
not comedy, all the time, if you will,
on Twitter. I mean, I think just again to tie this back to The Social Network. I mean, I see the sort of veil of irony, the protective veil of irony that Tim Heidecker embodies in this movie. Expressed on a daily basis on social networks, on Twitter in particular, in the way that certain people animate themselves and communicate almost exclusively through this detached sort of peevish anger.
It's what shitposting is. It's what Reddit, the depths of Reddit.
It is what shitposting is. That is a very...
This movie is about shitposting.
But there's because on Twitter you get a more well-rounded sense of who somebody is. It's not just an anonymous shitposter. Oftentimes, it's
I don't just tweet about the dark universe. If that's what you're getting at,
metastasizing from this. What's that?
I said I don't just talk about the dark universe all day. If that's what you're getting
right.
At.
Right. If only
is that what shitposting is? I feel like no. I don't have a good grasp.
I think I should post about the dark universe.
Irrelevant. But I just feel like you can really see on a long enough timeline. How someone is building a cocoon of a personality around the sort of behavior that you see Tim Heidecker doing. And it really felt, I think shitposting, if you want to call it that, in all of its manifestations, felt like it was very prescient about the way that people would protect themselves and inure themselves in the world on the internet. And it makes it a very, at least by my understanding of what the topic of this episode was, a very apt pick.
Katie, what did you think of the comedy?
Oh, I hated this movie. I hated every single minute that I spent watching this movie.
Good.
It is possible that if it was like a 15-minute short, I would have looked at it and said, this is interesting about all the things you guys have been talking about. But as 90 minutes of lingering within this character as a character study with no, like very deliberately, like no forward motion of what happens to this character from beginning to end, it felt repetitive and torturous to spend time in it. And like I said, like not enough like an exaggerated version of an actual human to feel like anything worth spending time with it. I knew in 2012 when you were talking about this the first time that I would probably hate it, and 7 years later I was right. I did.
You're
hate
too
it.
Close to it. You're a true Brooklynite. You're moving from liberal bubble to liberal bubble.
I mean, he's also in a liberal bubble. I don't know. Like it is in terms of movies about male privilege and ego that we're talking about in this episode, it felt like the most surface level, like using an extreme example of one thing to hammer home the same idea over and over again. Maybe I don't know enough people who like make dumb jokes on the internet to connect to it, but I still feel like 90 minutes of it was not necessary to get at the basic character study level that this was going for.
What was your least bored or painful sequence?
I like the part where they're all playing basketball on the basketball courts and then riding their bikes, and like the music that's kind of underscoring it, and the way that it like follows this like relatively carefree day with this kind of, I don't remember who did the score, but like the score kind
that
of
clip was the disintegration note. Loops.
Yeah, it's
that
the disintegration loops.
Yeah, it's like. I thought that part was like really
written
getting
after 9/11,
somewhere.
By the way,
it's like
written on the roof of it. Sorry to interrupt, Kitty, but this is well worthwhile context for the movie. It's like that I've always found that William Baczynski wrote the disintegration loops while looking over the burning wreckage of the World Trade
based
Center,
on decaying tapes that were he found in his in apartment. Which yeah,
there you go.
It's
so,
perfect
yeah,
for this.
That part of it hits all of that, and that comes about 25-30 minutes in, and then basically everything that happened after that, I was like, oh, we're still this. It's still just this.
There's some bike riding at the end.
He jumps in the ocean. He frolics.
Yeah, the frolic in the ocean was like not a convincing ending to this to me at all. Like, I don't know if that's supposed to be he has made progress or not. Like, I don't like that kid should be better monitored than playing with some stranger in the ocean.
No, I don't think he's made progress. I think he's still a child. I think he's more lost than ever before. Nothing has changed his path. And that's worrisome that all of these events do not alter his course, but he still thinks he gets a happy ending. I mean, that's terrifying. I think this movie has to pummel you. I think it has to go as far and, in your mind, one note. I don't know if it's one note because of just how extreme his affect gets. But
yeah, I mean, I guess if you go from like being inappropriate in a somewhat normal situation to being inappropriate in a totally unusual situation, that is a development, but it doesn't feel like his character, as you said, doesn't change at all.
Yeah, no, it's what the Joker should have been. That's what I'm saying. Every movie that we're talking about should have been
what
the Joker.
As I told you, seeing this the same week as Joker was a terrible turn of events for me.
Well, I guess that's the comedy. For me, it's a movie about behavior that has become more and more obstructed by the online experience. It's not, you know, when I saw it in 2012 or 2011, whenever the Sundance was, I guess I thought of it more as a hipster commentary. People in Brooklyn who were sick of the short wearing collared shirt sunglasses vibe that you would see everywhere in Williamsburg. I thought it was a very specific critique, and
the fashion was a very enjoyable throwback.
Yeah, you sent me a message that you thought I wore that outfit in like 2012, and F
you. You definitely
no way.
Absolutely.
I'll tell you why.
You had those sunglasses. What are you talking about?
I did have those sunglasses, but I don't wear shorts.
That's true. You might not wear shorts, but like the idea of like a button down
did,
with
like,
bright blue sunglasses
yeah,
and like at a picnic
with only
in Prospect
one of the
Park.
Buttons around the midsection.
So I'm saying I saw myself and I got scared. I was on the precipice. I could have been a Swanson maybe, but I pulled back.
You
helped me.
You look much more healthy and well kept than he does.
That's true.
You did in 2012. You do now.
But I do think Heidecker is like De Niro level in this movie. I'll go that far. And I've really learned more and more about this movie over the last decade. I see it everywhere. I see it on the left and the right. I see it in every corner of the internet. And I would implore people to watch the comedy, because we definitely did not sell it on it being an enjoyable experience.
It's not. You said it's not enjoyable.
It's not.
That's the point.
You should see it for homework.
Put Tim Heidecker on Little Gold Men or we riot.
Or we'll fight it out at last.
Let me just all say right. this about the next what? Seven. Now. Talk about it now, Katie.
Oh my God, guys. Lincoln. It turns out it's on Netflix. So I was like doubly glad that I chose it because now I get to just like go back and pick random scenes to watch whenever I want to. I had seen Lincoln. I think I saw it twice the year that it came out. Like, and it was one of those movies that I saw a second time and like really fell for even harder. And I've thought of it fondly since then. And then even without rewatching it, I kind of started to think of it as this emblem of the Obama era. It came out in 2012, the year that Obama was reelected. It came out, you know, but like weeks or like right around the time of the election. And it has this vibe about it, about history as being this movement forward. And it's all about the passing of the 13th Amendment and abolishing slavery and the idea of like the country making progress despite all of the different obstacles in politics, and has this kind of like affectionate but realistic look at the way that politics works. And even Abraham Lincoln, who I think Tommy Lee Jones's character calls like the purest man in the country, uses all these dirty tricks to get his law passed. And it is a relic of a period in a way that it doesn't, like a lot of movies in 2012 don't necessarily feel that way. You think about Ava DuVernay's The 13th documentary that came out and kind of showed the way that the 13th Amendment made slavery possible in prisons and how it was not the civil rights landmark that maybe a lot of white people would have wanted it to be. It's also this great time capsule of a ton of different actors who, I mean, what every single scene as you go through the movie, you're just like, holy shit, I forgot Jared Harris was Ulysses Grant in this movie. And I forgot about James Spader's whole subplot. And then Jeremy Strong is there as Lincoln's assistant, which is incredible because he was nobody then. He had actually been Daniel Day-Lewis's real life assistant, which is how he got the job. And watching Lincoln at the same time as Succession season two was really satisfying in that way. I don't know, like,
talked about being Daniel Day-Lewis's real life assistant, because I would love to listen to that podcast.
Someone like tweeted that at me as his IMDb credit, and I was like, okay, yeah, that all adds up. But yes, I would love to hear that. It's got like, I mean, like Bill Camp and Elizabeth Marvel have one scene together where they're these like Missouri people like coming to the White House to petition Lincoln. Like it's a talky movie, and it's stiff in some ways. And I think when I saw, like, I had a review at The Guardian, like a 3-paragraph first look review, which I had forgotten I ever wrote until I Googled it just now, about how it felt like uneven, which is something that on second, like, or third viewing, I didn't really feel at all. Like, as you can, like, sit with it more, it, like, gets into your head more. But I feel like, especially this time around, I really looked at it as this emblem of how white liberal Hollywood people like Steven Spielberg and Tony Kushner were thinking about the country in 2012 and how incredibly different that is from how we feel now. But, you know, maybe also a sign that we can get back to that point at some point.
Are you saying that great men from the party of Lincoln need to use slimy tactics to get their business done? This is a pro-Trump yes. film, and you're pro-Trump now?
See, what's great about all of the movies we're discussing is that none of them are about Donald Trump.
That's true.
He was not.
And yet
they're all about Donald Trump.
And yet maybe they are all about that. Yeah, I mean, Lincoln, like, I watched it kind of like a TV show on Netflix. Like, I would watch 45 minutes and then walk away and come back to it, which is not at all how it was intended, but was really satisfying. Like, I don't know if you guys, like, sat and watched through the whole thing, but it felt like something once you know the basic plot and what's going to happen and who's who, like, you can really jump in and out of it. It becomes more pleasurable to return to. Kind of like a book, like you can just dive in where you want to and watch a bit and then leave.
Can I say that I continue to find the comedy more on a basic level entertaining? Lincoln does make me very restless.
You love that Nick Nolte impression.
I do. It does not have any Nick Nolte impressions. It doesn't even have Nick Nolte.
You don't like when Lincoln's like, that's
Nick
some good pot.
Could be in that House of Representatives seat. You don't know that
there
for
are,
sure.
There are any number of roles Nick Nolte could have played in this movie. like John Wilkes Booth, Gemini Man, like the older John Wilkes Booth. He tries to stop him. but this movie does make me a little restless, but I think in smaller chunks, I can appreciate it more than I did the first time out.
What? Okay, so rewatching this movie, you're absolutely right. It is a play. I mean, Kushner has written a play. And
yeah, I mean, it's all set within like two rooms, basically. Like one room in the White House and then the House of Representatives.
I think this movie's top five Spielberg, and it has everything to do with all the camera movements. It's everything that The Post was lacking. What a horrible film compared to this expertly choreographed and framed. It's just so invigorating. Lincoln rots. I do wonder... It's so straightforward. How do you see it thematically summing up the decade? You just think it's like a political metaphor, like an allegory for what people go through now? How does it sum up the whole
decade? No, it feels
like
the Obama era to me. It feels like the sense of like our country is like accomplishing something, like we're getting together, like this is coming a couple years after Obamacare passes, and especially the idea of like racial equality being something that like America is capable of achieving. Like it comes in this period. Obama's been reelected. Like the Black Lives Matter movement is about to get started. The Trump thing's about to get started. I mean, the Tea Party's going, but it's something that like I think a lot of people felt like was like, okay, well, that's happening, but like it's not really what the country is. Like we make progress. And that's a big part of the decade. Like it's not, you know, the decade didn't start in 2016. It feels like a really important thing to remember that a big part of the tens felt like before it really pivoted.
Pivoted to bad. But do you see Kushner's script and maybe even Spielberg's direction? I don't know, but it's such Kushner's movie in a way.
Yeah.
Is he hard on Lincoln? He's tough on Lincoln's personality, but then he'll kind of go in a corner with different characters who are talking about like, oh, he's so soft-spoken, but he's also so powerful. Here's a demonstration of that.
The first scene of this movie basically tips the hand that he's not going to be hard on Lincoln. He's like sitting there and soldiers read the Gettysburg Address back to him.
Yeah. And black soldiers. I think you're right that it's really loving from that very first scene.
But does that but mean... I like it just as a, oh, sorry. Go, Dave.
I like it just as a process movie. Like, I like things about the first, like, dozen presidents. Like, they were weird and corrupt and some were okay, but they were all making it up as they fucking went along.
Yeah.
And, like, I love, like, Tommy Lee Jones in this movie, who, you know, is standing for what he believes in, but in the most, like, acerbic way possible, as was the custom at the time.
Yeah, and then you know, even he, when the time comes where he has to say that he believes in equality in the law, but not in all things or whatever, like he compromises for the sake of getting what he wants to do. Like he is like, people don't want to work with him because he is so steadfastly against slavery, which we all know is right, but he has to kind of work within the process to get what he wants, which, I mean, maybe if you want to talk about now, like I feel like the idea of like, you know, liberals tearing each other apart from the left, like trying to like pass each other against purity tests, Lincoln is a really good argument for different kinds of compromise to accomplish a greater good.
But that's when I wonder
if
level,
I think no, yeah. I just on that level, I think the film is very valuable and does resonate. I think you especially see this from both older and younger people, and not gloriously fair-minded middle-aged people such as ourselves. Dare I call us middle-aged? But I feel like I am intractably heading in that direction. But I think compromise has been one of my big political takeaways from the last 10 years. I think it's difficult to compromise when one side wants kids in cages and to exterminate pretty much everyone who isn't just white and make them subservient in some way and ruin the world. I mean, you don't really want to find.
Are you talking about the Democrats?
Is that exactly what Lincoln's about? Yeah, like you're talking about Lincoln, right?
Yeah. Party of Lincoln.
Yeah, well, I mean, no longer the part. As Dinesh D'Souza would tell you, Lincoln was on the other side, but and nothing has changed in the last 150 years.
No, I think it's actually much more what Katie's saying. Like the
I'm not disagreeing with Katie. I'm echoing Katie's point exactly.
You're recognizing that compromise feels especially hard now, but Lincoln is an argument.
It feels especially hard, and I think what Dave was jumping on was the idea that it's difficult to compromise with people who are morally bankrupt, but that. I think the big takeaway from the Obama presidency for me, which was far from perfect, both my takeaway and his presidency, is that politics, moving the world forward, is a game of inches. And really all you can hope to do in 8 years in the White House is move the football 2 or 3 inches down the field and not backwards, not take a fucking safety like we're doing right now. And I think, you know, there are definitely things the Obama policy that were risible, and the Obama administration that were risible. But I think, you know, understanding what's possible of somebody in that position with all the compromise and all the needles that they need to thread, I think it is a sad fact of reality that moving the football a couple inches down the field is a victory. Does that excuse the, you know, many lives that were lost in the process? Absolutely not. But I do think that a movie like Lincoln is valuable for how it tries to take as clear a view on the compromise and collateral damage that comes from it as can be possible without just sort of breaking down into a fit of regret and anger over what might have been and what was lost.
Yeah, I mean, he literally extended the Civil War to get this passed, like literal lives being lost in the process, and something he knows and he's like grappling with over the course of the movie, which is really like, I think I had forgotten about the stakes of that. Like that, like the war could be over that minute if he didn't try to get this this amendment passed. So yeah, it's like super extreme life or death.
I would say that if I were to make very small changes to this movie, I would cut Joseph Gordon-Levitt's scenes in half.
Sure.
Yeah. And I would turn down the Sally Field a scooch.
Scooch? Oh, like her volume?
Dial her down.
Just like the scene where she like has to kneel in front of him and like yell up at him is so much less powerful than the scene in the theater where she's like, "You will have to answer to me, good sir." And I'm like, that's the Sally Field that should have been.
Or the scene
when she's telling off Tommy Lee Jones.
Yeah, where he's in the receiving line and she holds everybody up to like yell at him.
I think it's, not that I dislike the yelling about who's grieving their dead child's more scene, because it's, you know, two good actors going at it, but the narrative of this movie is like much more centered around Lincoln trying to do something against the odds of the war and his family and whatnot. That I feel like the grief stuff is a hat on a hat. We already know.
And the
grieving for Lincoln himself that the movie does. I mean, I find the last 5 minutes of this movie wholly unnecessary.
They're a little much. You could basically end with like Stephen McKinley Henderson watching. Speaking of people I forgot were in this movie, watching him like walk out of the White House on his way to Ford's Theater and be like, "All right, fine."
It's weird. You know, it's like weird that Lincoln.
It's like the end of Lord of the Rings. Like he didn't want to say goodbye to the character. You can't hold it totally against him.
Yeah, it's weird that Lincoln goes in that submarine and gets trapped underwater, and then the aliens 2,000 years in the future actually come and retrieve him and show him full life. That was a choice. Kubrick wanted that originally, but yeah.
Did you guys have any actors you were especially happy or to be reminded being in this or to see again?
I mean, the pure joy.
Like the cavalcade of character actors is such a joy in this movie.
The pure joy of this movie is, all the goons doing the...
John Hawks Wheeling and James Spader.
James Spader. Yeah. Slapstick in the mud, running away from guns, shooting at them. Oh, that whole montage is incredible.
Yeah, Walton Goggins. I definitely didn't realize that was Walton Goggins back then. Who they're going to make the postmaster.
Lee Pace's charming white supremacist.
Yeah. I had forgotten Michael Stuhlbarg's in there as like the Kentucky.
What a Mark Zuckerberg move of Dave to find charm in a white supremacist.
There's so
next
many
thing you know, he's
going to
be
movie.
Meeting with conservative think tanks in private.
In the eyes of the law, good sir.
Before we close out on Lincoln, we haven't talked about the Oscars yet. Not that, you know, the comedy was obviously in the hunt that year and failed, but The Social Network and Lincoln both to me are like the also ran Best Picture contenders that are so obvious to me in retrospect and maybe obvious at the time that deserve to win. So that's my shadow Oscars.
This is 1 foot in Foxcatcher territory for me and 1 foot in reality.
Wait, what?
It's not a full
Oscar,
Foxcatcher.
Assuming your 2012 Oscar winner wouldn't have been Argo, what do you think should have won instead?
Who the fuck knows what's happening for a movie in 2012, Katie?
That's the right
Silver
answer.
Linings Playbook?
Ooh.
God, no.
I like that movie.
Is that Life of Pi year?
No.
That was Life of Pi year. Argo, Amour, Beast of the Southern Wild, Django Unchained, Les Mis, Life of Pi, Lincoln, Zero Dark Thirty.
You had me at Amour.
No, Zero Dark.
You had me at Amour. I'm looking for my Michael Haneke picture.
All right, so Patches picks Les Mis, obviously.
Yeah.
Let's go move on to another Best Picture nominee that didn't win.
Patch's two favorite filmmakers are Rick Alverson and Tom. Really running the gamut.
I do like the John Adams HBO miniseries that Tom Hooper did.
You were singing Cats before this.
No, that's better right. than Dave / Mark Zuckerberg.
All right.
Siding with
Let's round out this toxic white guy party with David's pick.
With the most bacchanalian of them all. Definitely a little bit more of a party than... I mean, Abraham Lincoln had Republicans and Democrats. But
some say retweets Jordan are Belfort. Endorsements when it comes to Martin Scorsese and right. The Wolf of Wall Street.
You've heard it, thing. Let me buy you a wedding ring.
So, right. I was trying to, I picked this movie, The Wolf of Wall Street by Martin Scorsese, 2013, as when, you know, under the criteria of the film that I thought, you know, from credits to credits, most summed up the energy in big picture macro terms of what, living, or at least living as an American, was like in conceptual level of the last 10 years.
What year was the Quaaludes scene?
I mean, that was election night 2016. It went on that long.
True.
Like, it's that percentage
has
of the decade.
Some Quaaludes in there, in like a filing cabinet or a safe somewhere, please. You can send them in an unmarked envelope to at FITWR. The U.S. Postal DM Service will know what to do. Yeah. Please do. We can 3D print them. We must have that technology. Yeah. Anyway, I do want to. So I was thinking today, after rewatching the movie last night, why, beyond the obvious, beyond the fact that I think this might be Martin Scorsese's best movie, which I know is a scorching hot take. But why, and the Trumpism of it all, and the obvious connections there, and some personal connections, and I think I have talked in a previous episode about family member of mine who ran a Ponzi scheme, has been in jail for a long time now, and reminds me a lot of the animating desires behind Jordan Belfort. I never saw a penny of that money, stolen or otherwise, so, oh well.
you didn't tape it to your body and go to Switzerland?
No, if only I would have. I did not. But, yeah, I mean, as you saw from Jordan Belfort, people who are of that nature are not typically overly concerned about sharing that wealth, so much as squirreling it away or keeping going, use Peter to pay Paul, and eventually wound up in jail. But that's neither here nor there. I think what clicked into place for me, why I thought this movie was befitting of this episode, was actually something, if I dare quote another critic, that I read in Richard Brody's review of the film. Richard Brody has been my wingman on the I don't know how to continue this analogy, but in the writing for Wolf of Wall Street as Scorsese's masterpiece along with me. And he wrote something that I think really hit the nail on the head for me, where he's talking about Belfort's misadventures and his Leonardo DiCaprio, as I assume most of you know. And he says that he has not just a self-defeating intelligence, but a self-punishing one. It took a sort of genius to conceive Belfort's plan, a talent to realize it, and stupidity to think he could get away with it. The smarts and the stupidity don't coexist side by side. They overlap. I think, and then it goes on to say, the risk is part of the pleasure, the anticipation of the fall is part of the thrill, the humiliation, degradation is built on the excitement of his success. For all of his crudeness, vulgarity, and cruelty, he's one of the high-wire elite. I think you guys can see where I am going with this, I would hope.
These movies are about Trump, oh God!
Oh boy, are they ever. And I think that Jordan Belfort, it's a great compliment to Donald Trump to compare him in any way to Jordan Belfort. And yes, I understand that Jordan Belfort
actually built
criminal.
Something himself and made a lot of
money. Indeed, he did. And he talked his way into doing so. I mean, as you see very clearly in The Wolf of Wall Street, it took a certain kind of deviant genius to outgross the Spike Joneses of the world who were trading on penny stocks. And I think the Bacchanalian sort of Caligula-like fun of the film does come from the idea that it is not one thing or the other. It is not stupidity at war with intelligence. It is not good sense fighting off bad. It is a swirl of the two of them where one side animates the other. It's a cyclical reaction. It is like a drug addict, and he is a self-admitted drug addict, Jordan Belfort. Who knows what the fuck Donald Trump's putting in his body other than fast food. But it must be some sort of benzos. Anyway, but I think that, you know, it is the highs and the lows. It's chasing the dragon. It's all of that. It's just, it is a sort of uncut gems need to keep going. When we talk, you know, uncut gems we can talk about for next decade, even though I guess it's technically this one, but we will never stop. Never stop with the uncut gems as a preview of things to come. But I see that same energy, that same, you know, needing to make more and more money hand over fist because he has an innate belief that he would spend it better than somebody else would, that it's more valuable to him, sort of has a divine right to that money than someone else does. And the moral high ground, the superiority that he takes over Kyle Chandler's character for worshiping a different kind of power. I mean, Kyle Chandler's character is also no angel. He is pursuing his own sense of justice because he wants the power that comes with that as well. But I think that there is a sense for Jordan Belfort that his, he conflates his wealth with his worth, with his, the score that he's keeping on life. All these things I think are, and especially the loyalty to him. For me, the most, and I want to turn it over and stop monologuing. For me, the single most important scene in this entire movie might be when it, very early on, when they have the first party at Stratton Oakmont, and they pay one of the female, brokers of the firm $10,000 to shave her head. Mm-hmm. And then they do, and this party breaks out around her. But then Scorsese cut, and Scorsese and Thelma Schoonmaker, of course, cut back to, the shot of her when she has strands. She looks like she's just been in a fucking concentration camp. You know, she has strands, what few remaining strands she has left of her hair, you know, going down to almost her waist. And you can see the self-loathing, the fear, the shame, this swirl of unfortunate emotions cascading over this woman's face as everyone is, you know, going to fucking town around her. And she sort of takes her $10,000, which someone hands her like a payoff, and slips into the crowd to be alone in a bathroom somewhere that we never see. And like, there's something about the ugliness of that, the dehumanization of that. But she doesn't, I mean, there's no scene of her quitting. There's no scene of her leaving. I mean, there are asides about people who killed themselves 2 years later and he doesn't really give a fuck. But that, like, she is sort of folded back in a Stratton Oakmont. There's still that feeling of loyalty you see and actually best expressed through other female characters in the movie, like the one with the Chanel blazer, who, and these people all go down with the ship. They all get fucked when Jordan Belfort, you know, walks away. Yeah. But, you know, it's like the loyalty of money. How it supersedes morality and how the people at the top are always going to look out for themselves. I mean, it was ever thus, but there's something about the high wire insanity of it all, the sheer head rush of this particular moment in time, the way these people did it, that brings it all into a sort of fuck it all, you know, tongue wagging clarity that you don't get out of a more sober, version of this story. And for that reason, I think that it is, as lucid a portrait as the way the power works and continues to work in a capitalistic society as any.
Yeah, I was thinking as you were monologuing endlessly, like Jordan Belfort might.
I'm not fucking going!
I don't know. I don't think Wolf of Wall Street's a particularly deep film. You know, I don't think Scorsese has to burrow too far to make his point. And yet the movie goes, it's 3 hours long. And it's just a, it's a blast because of the visceral filmmaking you're talking about, because it's really capturing a sense of how you would get sucked up in this hurricane of ego and charisma and greed. And you have to have someone as energetic as Scorsese and his camera to make it all work and stage these kind of lampoon scenes and goof on the decade and talking to camera. And it's a circus. But it's not that deep. And I think that's interesting that it can still be really resonant and make a point and take that long to do it. And it doesn't need to be 3 hours. Does it need to be this excessive?
I think it should have been four.
Yes, it does. It should be four. You love every minute of it. You want to be,
you want to feel like you're doing cocaine. Yeah, no, I mean, were you at the end of that coming around to say it does need to be this long? Or
yeah, no, I'm saying it needs to go that long. It needs to have that slow entry. You need to feel how Jordan gets seduced and becomes the seducer and how much cocaine it takes to get to where he's going and make all the poor decisions and destroy so many lives in the process.
Speaking of poor decisions that destroyed a lot of lives, Paramount's decision to not release the 4-hour like assembly cut or whatever cut that they were toying around with originally on the Blu-ray as they had initially intended, destroyed a lot of lives.
Think about how actually inessential the Matthew McConaughey character is. Like, he's in the beginning of the movie. He's like clearly the guy who like showed him the way into this industry, but he doesn't really have anything to do with the rest of the movie. Easily they could have cut him out and the story would have worked the same way, but his scene is so good. It was like a key part of the trailer. It's kind of essential. This came at like the height of the McConaissance. It's the year he beat Leonardo DiCaprio for the Best Actor Oscar. And it's so satisfying that you see someone like Martin Scorsese, who is willing to let his movies run that long, in a studio who will let it run somewhat long, I guess not the full 4 hours intended. I might sound like a hypocrite for saying the comedy should have been 15 minutes long and Wolf of Wall Street needs to be 3.5, but damn it, I'm right.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but sorry, Dave, go on.
Oh, no, I think that I really like the McConaughey thing because when McConaughey's introduced, he is so, like, outside and weird because he's from the end of the movie. And so when we see, like, that, when we see that scene, we're like, we're on Jordan's side. And at this point, Jordan's still our hero. You know, he's still tried to, How I Met Your Mother, make it work. Try in the stock world. And we see Matthew McConaughey and we're like, absolutely, this guy is like a fucking sociopath and like crazy and like drinking too much and like doing cocaine.
I love it. You're describing him as someone sent back in time. You know, like he's from the end of the movie. He got terminatored back to fuck up Jordan Belfort's life.
Well, and then he doesn't talk about him. He's not like, this guy taught me everything. He doesn't do anything. He doesn't come up again until Jordan decides he's not going to leave and like fuck the government. And then he starts doing the chest pound again. And you realize that Jordan has become the Matthew McConaughey that was sent back at the beginning of the movie for these hundreds of other like poor people that aren't going to be able to replicate his success. So I love the McConaughey scenes.
When you speak about, you know, hundreds of other poor people who are not going to be able to replicate his success, you know, that is the very last shot of the movie, which is, you know, part of what the controversy was surrounding the movie initially, this bogus idea that Martin Scorsese was somehow endorsing Jordan Belfort's behavior. But, you know, that really is, it's that last shot more than anything Leonardo DiCaprio does in the movie that connects The Wolf of Wall Street to Trumpism for me more than anything else. Well, not that that is the sole criteria by which a movie should be measured, but, you know, it's the people in the audience whose lives are starved for anything but this capitalistic hope and are not at all put off by the price that is paid to get to that point, by the crimes that are committed, by the immorality of it all. They are still blinded by the need for money. They are following the cult of money and the people who claim that they can make them for them. And, you know, I think it's Leonardo DiCaprio selling them that pen at the end and for a price that might drive some of them into the ground.
But I'm surprised.
It's really easy to see a MAGA rally. It's nice that this movie is not explicitly about Donald Trump himself. Like, there's no sense of like Jordan Belfort becoming president, but it's the exact same animating instinct.
But that's what, so David, that's what's so interesting, because you have no sympathy for MAGA heads and people who follow Trump, and yet you can understand both why there's a level of enjoyment to Wolf of Wall Street. The point that Scorsese's making is that you, the audience member, can get swept up, and why it could feel like an endorsement on Scorsese's part is because Wolf of Wall Street is really fun. By the end, you should realize that if you get caught up in the fun, you've been caught in Jordan Belfort's spell, and that is ultimately bad. And yet, you have no empathy for these people who have been mesmerized by the Belfortian figure that is Trump.
Are you telling me or asking me?
Well, I'm really asking you why you don't, but I feel like I'll know the, I know the answer.
Why don't you?
You can understand the language of this film and why you get frustrated at people who think it's an endorsement.
I don't think empathizing with the people who are in the audience of the sales class he's teaching at the end is at all have anything to do with having with thinking that the movie endorses Jordan Belfort. I mean, it's a matter of support versus, or pity versus support. But I think it's certainly easier to empathize with rubes, with ourselves. I mean, I'm sure in our own lives, as high and mighty and witty as we like to think we are, that we've fallen into all sorts of traps, large and small. And I think the difference is why it's easier to empathize with these people, with Trump people, is because they're looking out for, they are on the most literal level looking out for themselves. You know, aside from the collateral damage that comes with it, looking to provide for themselves and their families and all these things, that's like the basic function of it all beyond all that's wrapped up in it, and are not, you know, it's not punitive the way that it is among Trump supporters, where they are attacking people of color and Jews and poor people and migrants and like so on and so on. And it really comes from a place of hostility and hatred. And so it's easier to feel bad for the people in the audience, even though I do think a lot of MAGA voters are on the similar journey that you very articulately described about, you know, going from that place being wrapped up in the excitement of it all, like, oh, the president's coming to town, he's going to shit talk Nancy Pelosi, and this is so much fun. Maybe someone get beaten up at the rally. This is great. Again, I'm putting myself in some twisted shoes, but then, like, you know, at the end there will be the sort of same sort of crushing nothingness.
To contextualize, I think, within this episode, it's like stuff like Social Network. It's interesting to see, and you know, like maybe pity those people. And then Wolf of Wall Street, it also seems like pitiable because at a certain point, if you like buy into capitalism, you're like scorpion and frogging yourself. But I don't know if I'm going to be on the southern side for racism just because they have a capitalist argument. They're also racists. So I don't think, yeah, I don't know if we should, how forgiving we should be about racism, but I do think that being capitalists in a capitalist
not
society, we can all, we can empathize with that a little easier.
I'm not saying forgiving by any means. I'm saying being empathetic for people who've been brainwashed by a Jordan Belfort type.
But I don't think that I people in, I think, you know, the people who work at Stratton Oakmont are not necessarily brainwashed. I think they are detached from the consequences of their actions, which is another thing that I find really.
Well, they're addicts. They're all addicts. I mean, the drug extends beyond the pill.
This is something that you see in a film that's very very well expressed in a film like Parasite, where you have one of the mechanisms of, that perpetuates capitalism is a distance of an obfuscating distance between the money, the moneyed people. And the consequences of their actions and the accruing all of that wealth. I mean, there are literal blindness to what is happening. And I think sitting in an office in Midtown Manhattan or in Wall Street and being in a phone bank and not having to directly engage the people whose lives you're destroying is something that I see that empathy gap is something that I see very strongly in so many areas of our world today, not just within the MAGA universe, but definitely there as well. When you know, lock her up and talking about immigrant. I mean, it's all these concepts, all these things that are the other, the enemy that they're hostile towards that are getting in the way supposedly of their own happiness are abstract concepts where in reality, they are in fact real lives.
Yeah.
And like, there is such a trail of, I mean, it's something that Wolf of Wall Street gets at early and often when you have those voiceover asides about, you know, as we mentioned earlier, the coworkers of Stratton Oakmont who killed themselves, or even the ones later, like, what's his face, that character actor who's in everything, John Bernthal, who, dies. It's like, yeah, what, I don't know, fucking whatever. Like, it's drilling into you that sense of how easy it is to not care. How, you know, how inviting it is, especially when money is brought into the mix and the momentum of that all it is to detach yourself from all of that, and the bigger
and how the system, power. Like as he points out, when he's in prison, he's like, "I live in a country where everything's for sale." Like he gets this cushy prison sentence because he has the money for it. Like it's built to create people like him, and like it's not just being like brainwashed by a Jordan Belfort type. Like as Dave was saying, like capitalism will have its consequences for you, whether or not you're playing this kind of game.
Absolutely.
It's going to turn us all into socialists.
Yeah, uh-huh. Slowly.
Yeah.
I wonder what Bernie Sanders thinks of the Wolf of Wall Street.
The real Wolf of Wall Street was love.
Oh, I bet Bernie Sanders loved the Wolf of Wall Street.
No, you
do
know what?
Do you feel like all of these movies held up? Like, all of, like, of, the comedy aside, like, for me, like, all three of the movies, revisiting them. Well, I hadn't seen the comedy either before.
That's
really
a good
feel like they held up almost more than I would have expected.
I think that, absolutely. I think that is sort of the, if whatever the criteria was for picking these movies, we were in the back of our heads all thinking of the movies that were going to hold up because they captured something vital and alive about the last 10 years. I think the Social Network, especially The Wolf of Wall, I mean, obviously I'm biased towards my own pick, but
yes,
I think those two movies, I think that the comedy is more of a time capsule, which is not to say that it feels dated, but it really drills into a particular point in time. Whereas The Wolf of Wall Street and Social Network feel somehow more, I don't know. They're always in season. Yeah, and Lincoln.
I'm glad we finally abolished slavery in 2012. I will say that was very important.
Is that the end?
All right, I think that's going to be it.
Wow.
So guys, until our next episode, next week, which will be a normal episode, where can people find more of you around the internet? Let's start, as we never do, this week with Katie Rich.
Oh, so I don't like get to the end. I'm just like, wait, is it my turn? I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at vanityfair.com on the Little Gold Men podcast, where we're talking about all kinds of movies that are out right now, unlike this episode, which is more looking in the past. You can find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRach. And we're all on Twitter at FITWR. There's no lightning round question to answer this week, so I'll just hand it over to whoever.
People could pick their own movie.
Yeah, there you go. But tell us your choice for the movie that sums up the decade. That's a good idea.
Ooh, I like that. Yeah.
Also, I would love to hear other people's like requests for quarter quells. I feel like that's how we wound up with the Netflix foreign films one, but it'll obviously be a while before the next one. But
well, you ignore all my dad's Facebook messages, so.
I mean, I'm not the one who checks our Facebook.
How different my life is going to be in 25 weeks.
That's true.
Yeah, that's a good point. Hey, David, tell people where they could find you on the internet in this
David's
brief pre-child period.
David's decade of the 2020 decade is going to be Boss Baby 2.
Yeah.
Boy, my kid will never know what the fucking Boss Baby is, so help me God. I am, and if any of you tells my kid what the Boss Baby is, I'm coming after you.
That's Boss Baby.
I'm David Ehrlich. I just hear the words Boss Baby bouncing around my head. What am I? I'm the senior film critic for IndieWire. I am on Twitter at David Ehrlich. You can find all of us on iTunes, and I really hope you do, at Fighting in the War Room. Leave us a review. It's invaluable to the show. We read them all on air, unfiltered. It's a great fun for everyone. It's the best time you can have without strapping a bunch of cash to your body and doing quaaludes.
Ooh. And Mr. Matt Patches, champion of the Gemini Man.
I am Matt Patches. I am a Gemini. I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches, and I am the senior editor at Polygon.com, and we'll see you in 2020.
Well, and I mean, and also next week.
This is not the last episode.
No. I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You can find me on the Storm Podcast. You can find our previous quarter quells by going to fightinginthewarroom.com. You will see a little piece of text that says Fitwer, and the text has an arrow next to it. That's a menu. You click on the menu. You go to quarter quells. Boom. You're done. They're all right there. They're listed there. You can download the MP3s because some of them are older than our RSS feed. And because we're old. We're all old. We've covered at least two decades worth of best decade movies. So let's move forward. And I don't know. Star Wars. We'll see you next week.
Bum-ba-dum. I'm done. We're done.